God, please set aside everything I think I know about you, the steps, recovery, the big book, what's best for me, what's best for others. Especially help me let go of all my old ideas so I can live in your truth. Heavenly Father, thank you for your grace and mercy on me. Help us to glorify you today by carrying your message. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we're finishing up the steps we took on step 11. I live on pages 84 to 88. We have a couple people who haven't been here for the whole thing, and I'm going to start and review the instructions in the big book on prayer and meditation, and then we'll finish the handout. So we'll go to page 86 in the book. Anybody have your big book? You don't have a big book, Matt?
I don't have one.
Share with James. So the instructions on prayer and meditation in the big book have at night, and then in the morning, and then facing indecision, and then a prayer for the day, and then it talks about how we pray, and then the final instruction is the pause instruction that we'll spend some time on page 87. And so we've gone through this, and we talked about doing the resentment inventory last week, and everybody's going to do it for a week, and I see quite a few people didn't show up because they didn't want to tell us how they did it during the week. It's true, right? It says, when I retire at night, I constructively review my day. I want to constructively review my day. Why? And why do we start with the night? Why did they start with the night? Because you want to clear your head out before you wake up. So when you wake up, you're not cluttered with the crap from the day before. You see that? And also, the Judeo-Christian day started at sundown. And that was the beginning of the day. And I think it makes sense, because they're going to tell you when you retire at night how you're going to clear yourself and look at your day constructively. Why do you want to do that? Because if you don't do that, you still carry the crap around. And what are we looking at in our day? We're looking at where we were separated from God. Now, at the 10th step, which it's on 84 to 86, is how do you live with God each day? And you want to live with God each day, because if you're not, you're not going to be at peace. You'll be disturbed. Now, of course, we get disturbed, so step 10 is where you get disturbed and undisturbed all day long. And you use the tools in steps 4 through 9. Anytime you get a resentment or just angry or irritated, you learn to recognize it, you say the prayers, and you're free of it. Anytime you get a fear during the day, you're threatened in some way, you say, the fear's not real. God, remove the fear. You say the prayer, remove the fear, and direct my attention to how I should be. Well, be in the now. Do what you need to do. Don't worry about something that hasn't happened yet. Be grateful for what you have. Trust in me. Trust in God. Let me demonstrate through you, God, will demonstrate through me what I can do, and I just need to play the role he assigns. And then I can handle calamity with serenity. That's what it says in the big book. When you get angry or judging somebody, you don't like them, you know how that is. They do something you don't like, you have to say the four prayers right away, because you don't want to be separated from God. Remember, anger kills us. It says it. It's poison. And how do you get rid of anger? You say, God, give me love, tolerance, and patience, and consideration, and kindness to blank, whatever it is. How can I be helpful to this person? Changing it, and then God save me from being angry at whoever it is. Because you have to be saved from the anger. You don't pray for the other person. They don't need it. You need to be free from the anger. You're going to die. Why do people die over anger? Because when you're angry, you're separated from God, and then you don't feel good, and then you drink or you use. It's not complicated. It says it's the number one offender. Anybody disagree with that? It kills more alcoholics than anything else. And it says a life run on resentment is a futile and unhappy. And it says when you harbor these resentments, you're blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit. And when you're in resentment, you squander all the hours that are worthwhile. Is there anything good about resentment? Well, some people say, well, we went to the moon because we had a resentment against the Russians. I think that's just ridiculous. We went to the moon because of our self-centered pride that we had to show the Russians that we were better than them. Nobody ever says that. We weren't going to let the Russians beat us to the moon. Young people are looking at me like I'm a lunatic, but you know, in the 50s we had the Cold War. We had the Cold War and they put the first guy in space. So we had to put the first guy. We had to get to the moon. And we spent a lot of money by getting to the moon. I don't know, they say there were benefits, but it was not because of we did a good thing out of resentment. I don't know what good we did, but it was our pride. And we were afraid that the Russians would beat us. And then they would tell us they're better than us. So you see, that was a resentment that caused us to go to the moon. Now, we may have wanted to go to the moon. I may not be saying it quite right, but I've heard people say they're good resentments. You know, the guy fixes his yard and you hate that his yard's so good and yours is so ugly. So then because of the resentment, you clean up your yard. Well, that may be true. But most resentments, self-centered resentments, are killers. And then I told you the fear prayer. And then the other instruction in step 10 is if you harm somebody, you want to apologize right away. Now, how do you know if you harm somebody? You may have to call somebody. You may be angry at someone and you call someone and you realize you owe them an amends. And so you look at your day and it's one paragraph in the big book, remember? It's the acronyms WADAT. It says we watch for what? Selfishness, society, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, just the beginning of separation, you do what? What do you do? Ask God at once to remove them. That's not complicated. I think even alcoholics can understand that. We ask God at once to remove it. Then we discuss it with another person. And then we make amends promptly. And then what's the T? We turn our thoughts resolutely to those we can help. In other words, get out of your head, Michael. Turn it and who do you help? And to me, that in the office, it meant go see the next patient, Michael. You know, you got things to do. Stop worrying about what happened 3 days ago or some nonsense in your head. You see how wadded it. It's one paragraph on how you live. And so then at night you review how well you did. Did you watch? Did you ask at once? No. So it says at night, we retire at night, we constructively review our day because we want to see how well we did because we want to do better tomorrow. And remember, you can't, in AA, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't improve unless you see the truth. You face the truth and you ask God for how you can be different, remember? And then step 6 and 7 is where you don't want to practice your character defects anymore, and they're on the card here, right? And so you're going to watch all day for these character defects, and then when they crop up, you're going to ask God to help practice the opposite. And then at night, you're going to say, well, gee, I was over here quite a while before I went over here. How'd that work for me? So it says, was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? It doesn't say if. Were we? Were you ever angry or disturbed at all? Were you ever selfish? Were you not honest in your motives or your actions? And did you have any fear? Now, there's not a day goes by that alcoholic doesn't have some one of that. If it does, let me know. I want your blood. But it doesn't have to dominate us anymore. See, now we have tools that when they crop up, we can ask God at once to remove it. Because in the fourth step, we've learned that none of these this thinking is just leads to a life that's futile and unhappy. Do we owe an apology? You think about it. Well, do I owe an apology? Should I have sent the email? Should I have yelled at the person in the store who had the 500 coupons in front of me and made me wait for 5 hours? You know, I'd say that, but I really don't get upset anymore. I don't have any place to go. But, you know, is my wife ever going to stop correcting my driving? We just left the house. She's already starting on me. You're in the wrong lane. You didn't do that. And then I just say, well, that's the way it is. Do we owe an apology? And you don't want to have to do apologies because you don't want to take any bad actions anymore and harm anybody, right? But sometimes we do, and we can see it, so we want to apologize the next day. You know how you know you owe somebody an apology? You're bothered at night by them. You're thinking about them. There's something that happened during the day that bothered you. You didn't act and fit spiritual conditions to that. You weren't with God. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Yeah, I shouldn't have stolen $1,000 out of the cash register, or maybe I should tell somebody, or you did something, or something happened that's bothering you. You need to call somebody. I've asked people to call me when they're disturbed. They never do. They always call me to tell me how great they're doing. And that's fine, I'm glad, but were there things that happened during the day that you want to discuss? Did somebody do something and you reacted and you said something and you want to talk about it? And you're doing it so that you can clear your head of this. Does this make sense? Then there's a simple question, were you kind and loving towards Saul? Well, I thought was that, did I act kind and loving towards James? But no, I have a new thought on that. Was I kind and loving in my mind towards everybody? Like, did the name come up and I went, ugh. And I just have to say, oh, I need to be kind and loving. And it just changes your attitude. So you want to see people in a kind and loving way in your head. You don't want to see them in a negative way. What could I have done better? That's a good question. You know, I should have paused, which we're going to talk about, right? I should have paused. Was I thinking of myself most of the time? These are great questions, aren't they? I mean, who was I thinking about? Was I thinking about God and serving Him, or was I thinking of myself? Now remember, we're supposed to carry a vision of God's will in all of our activities. His will, not mine, be done, right? But you can't do that if you're thinking about yourself. Now, God's vision of me in all my activities is not to be thinking about me all the time. Anybody not think about themselves during the day? Anybody ever not do that? But you don't want to do it all the time. Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? You see, my role in AA is to be a fit myself maximally spiritually to serve God and others. And this is one of the ways I fit myself is doing this nightly review. And how do I fit myself during the day? I do those instructions on page 84. You don't want to react during the day if you're not in fit spiritual condition. Now, what does that mean? It means you want to be connected to God. And you want to bring love, patience, kindness, tolerance, considerate compassion to all your activities. If you bring hate, anger, fear, things aren't going to go well. Was there anybody at work that you didn't like, and you see them coming down the hall, and they're coming towards you, and you just say, oh, here she comes. Well, that's not going to be a good interaction. It has to be, oh, she has something we need to discuss. How can I be kind and loving to her? And it makes a big difference. Now, she may not be kind and loving to me, but it doesn't matter. I'm the one that wants to be at peace. And so you see how it changes your whole attitude? Do these instructions make sense? But it says, I must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Why do you think they put that in? Because we're alcoholics. We could just go, oh, poor me, and oh, look what happened, and they didn't do this and that. And you see, we change it from inventorying our separation from God to inventorying them. Or feeling sorry for ourselves. And alcoholics are very good at doing that very quickly. It's like changing lanes in the highway. We can just do it. And we don't want to do that anymore. Why? What does it say? It would diminish my usefulness to others. I want to be useful to others. I can't be useful to others if I'm in worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Now remember, worry is God's job. When I worry, I'm doing God's job because I've given my life to Him. He's going to give me everything I need. And if I stay close to Him and do His work, well, I'll have everything I need. And remorse, you'll feel shame and guilt, right? Well, you handle that by you making amends. So that might be somebody, or morbid reflection means that you're seeing it and it's become self-pity. Now, after making a review, this is a very important instruction in the Big Book. every night I ask God's forgiveness. I say, God, forgive me. Just forgive me. I'm a sinner. Forgive me. And if there was something during the day, I ask him to forgive me. And then I ask God, not me, I inquire what corrective measures should be taken. Now that's the thing people forget. God, what corrective measures should be taken? And you ponder that. And then you go to sleep and you wake up and the right answers are there. Or you might ask God what corrective measures and think about it. It's very powerful. So that's the nightly inventory. It's one paragraph in the big book. You don't have to write anything. You're not going to have it read on CNN. You're not going to be graded. It's how well do you want to connect to God. This is how you improve your conscious contact with God. That's all we're trying to do. And why are we doing that? So we can be more useful to him and others. And when we're useful to God and others, we feel better. Isn't it silly? The more we get out of ourselves, the more we try to help other people, the better we feel. The more we're in ourselves and we try to get what we want, the worse we feel. Isn't that screwed up? And I lived my whole life and I didn't realize I had it backwards. Now you wake up. Most people wake up. Is anybody going to wake up tomorrow? I hope so. It says, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours a day. That sounds good, doesn't it? We consider our plans for the day. Makes sense. Ben, sound good? But they give you a warning. Don't do that. It says, before you do that, ask God to direct your thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or selfish motives. So what they're saying is, okay, don't think about your plans because they're your plans. Stop. Ask God, I say God every morning, God, direct my thinking, divorcing it from selfish, dishonest, self-seeking motives. I want my motives to be focused on serving you, God, and others. It's doing the third step every morning. And it really helps. It doesn't take long to do that, does it? But it means that I know if I'm managing my day, I can't do it. I can't run my life successfully. I need God. Under these conditions, if God's directing my thinking, now this is very important. Most people don't realize this in AA. You get your mind back on page 86. You can't use your mind till you get to page 86 in AA. Because it says, under these conditions, where God's directing your thinking, you can employ your mind all you want with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use, but you use your brains divorced from selfish, dishonest, self-seeking motives. It's not a complicated program. Now, how do you know when your thinking was not divorced? Well, you're disturbed. Where were you resentful, angry, selfish, or afraid? You see how it works? And then it says, and this is another key line, my thought life, that's the only life we're worried about in AA, is your thinking life, because the life that the action of what happens is all dependent on your thinking. And my thought life will be placed in a much higher plane when my thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So that's really important for me to remember. My motives have to be good. In thinking about my day, I may face indecision. Here's the third instruction. Alcoholics, when they come in, are never indecisive. They always know what to do. And they have a whole slew of bad decisions they've made. I like to have indecision. It means I don't know everything. It says we may not be able to determine which course to take. So what they're saying here is during the day, things are going to come up. And they come up and you don't have to react right away. You don't have to know the right answer. It says, I'm going to stop and ask God for inspiration. I pray, God, give me inspiration and intuitive thought or decision. You go to God. You relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. It is amazing how you'll have something that you're struggling with, and I say, well, I'll give it to God or put it in the God box, and then you go to sleep and you wake up and you've got a whole new way to look at it. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. So you can start to trust your thinking here because you're asking God for direction. being still in experience and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that we're going to be inspired at all time. I've had people, they're sober a month or 6 weeks, and they call me and they tell me they got a plan. They got something they're going to do. And I say, well, really? Who told you that? Oh, God, this is what God wants me to do. I've said, wow. Ask him again. Call him back. Because it sounds kind of preposterous, but you don't know what to say to them. And I said, well, you might want to think about that. Write it out. Write out the pros and cons. Why do you want to do this? Because it says we may pay this presumption. That's why you really shouldn't make a lot of major, like, relationship decisions in early recovery, major decisions, changing jobs, things like that, early in recovery, because you don't know that you're just learning how to live with God, and you might make mistakes. It says, we may pay for this with all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more the plane of inspiration we come to rely upon it. So I like asking God, what do I need to do? What's the right thing to do here? And the key thing is to pause when you're not feeling right about something, and ask God what to do. And he's going to talk about that in the bottom of this page. We're in 87. So we conclude the meditation. You're doing this in the morning with a prayer. You're going to pray. And this is a very complicated prayer. It says, God, show me all through the day what my next step is to be. That we be given whatever I need to take care of this problem. So God, show me all day what the next thing is that I need to do, and give me whatever I need to take care of such problems. Now, it doesn't say I'm going to do the next right thing. It doesn't say that, because I never knew what the next right thing was. I made a lot of mistakes doing the next right thing. It says, I ask God to show me all through the day what my next step is to be, and I be given whatever I need to care of such. And if I don't know what the next step is, then I'm indecisive. So then I ask God for inspiration, intuitive thought, and decision. See how it ties? And you relax and take it easy. And here's what you're supposed to pray for. You're to pray for freedom from self-will. That's the key. And I'm careful to make no requests for myself. I go to church now, and we have a lot of prayer requests. And we're supposed to pray for people and pray for this and that. And that's good. And, you know, that they get better and things like that. But I don't do that for me. I just want to be free from self-will. I leave the day and what happens up to God. I just want to be serving him. I'm not into, I don't worry about the results. I worry about just doing his will. If I do God's will, then I'll be okay. It doesn't matter what happens. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. So you may ask for, like, a new car so you can drive people to the meetings. That's not what they're talking about. You ask for yourself if others will be helped. So God, give me the ability to do a good job tonight and teach your lessons so that someone might be helped by this. I'm not doing this for me, I'm doing it for God. And it's helping me, I'm learning stuff. Again, the more I review it, the better I get. Now here's what it says. It says, be careful. When they say be careful, it means, hello, don't do this. Never to pray for your own selfish end. And I was in this room, it must have been 15 years ago, and some lady was arguing about that she needs to pray for what, blah, 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 blah. And then she went on to all of her resentment list and all of that. It was really pretty ugly. See, I don't want to pray for my own selfish ends because I don't know what I need. And remember, expectations is resentment waiting to happen. And I don't want God to be my co-pilot. I just want to do his will. So I don't want to pray for my own selfish ends. And it says, many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that. It doesn't work. You can easily see why. My prayers really are focused entirely on doing the will of the Lord and how I can be the best person he made. It's not that complicated. Can I be loving and kind and tolerant to everybody? Some days I do really well, and some days I hit a little fork in the road, but I try to get back really quick. But we all have, we still have our self-will. We still have our self-centered personality. So we recognize it, and some days we do better, but I want to try to keep moving forward. I'm certainly better than I used to be. I don't even need people to tell me that anymore. I don't need approval from others. I know I'm doing better. I feel better. Now, here's the key instruction, the whole book. This is the program in three lines. As I go through the day, I pause. This is what they did when agitated or doubtful. What does agitated mean? You're bothered. Something's bothering you. Or doubtful, fearful. So if you're not connected to God, if you're either in the past or the future, or you're worried about what's going to happen, you have to pause. Now, why do you pause? Because pause allows God to come in. It's not complicated. Just pause and say, God, come in right now. And it says, I ask God for the right thought or action. God for the right thought. Pause, get God, get back to God. I'm agitated or doubtful. That means I'm separated from Him, I'm disturbed, I'm bothered. I ask God for the right thought or action. Just doing that helps. It keeps you from reacting. It gets you centered. And let me tell you, when you ask God for the right thought or action, it happens. God's not going to ignore you. While you're doing this, it says you constantly remind, I have to remind myself I'm no longer running the show. See, I pause when anything's bothering me. I ask God for the right thought or action. I say, listen, I'm not supposed to be running the show. And I humbly say, thy will be done. Then here's the promise. If you do that, you're in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. You see what happens if you don't pause? You get excited, fearful, angry, worry, self-pity, foolish decisions. You harm people. And then look, here's another promise. You become more efficient. I was tired when I was self-centered imagining the world. It's exhausting. And what does it say? We do not tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as I did when I was trying to arrange life to suit myself. That summarized my whole life. I just tried so hard to arrange life so I would be okay, and it never worked. Now I'd be okay by not arranging life to suit me, and by arranging life to suit God's will for me. It's good. Sounds good, doesn't it? But I'm not perfect at this. But it really, the more you know these paragraphs, the better you do it, the quicker to do it. It says it works. It really does. It does work. It says we alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. How does God discipline me? I get agitated or doubtful. I get disturbed. I don't feel good. And he's saying, well, come back to me, Michael. Come on. Let it go. Come to me. And then he gives me a hug. Isn't it amazing? It's kind of like the story of the prodigal son in a way for alcoholics. We separate ourselves from the Father, but he's waiting for us. But the prodigal son is a lot more complicated than that. I'm teaching it in Sunday school. God's there for us. But this is not all. There's action and more action. Constant action. And it says, faith without works is dead. So what's the fruit of your faith? Are you helping people? Are you serving God or others? Are you kind and loving towards all? Are you thinking of others and what you can pack into the stream of life? You get it? And so without doing this work, you may have faith, but it's not going to be manifest in your life. It's dead faith. Dead faith won't work for an alcoholic, because we need faith that's alive that can tell us alcohol's a bad idea, right? We can't have dead faith. So we have to do the works constantly. And so we can have faith and die of alcoholism, because without the works, it won't make us alive. Now, this is different than the scriptural. We're not getting into lordship, salvation, all that other stuff, or faith plus works or any of that. The way it's meant here is that if you're not doing the deal, you don't have the relationship with God. You have a dead relationship, and then the faith doesn't mean anything. Remember, you don't want to be an agnostic, that who's without knowledge of God. You want to have a knowledge of God. You want to have a relationship with God. And so that's the way I see it today. I may see it different tomorrow. Did that make any sense? And so I want to keep my faith alive. Because what they're really saying is, faith without works, you don't have any conscious contact. And I need conscious contact with God because my problem is conscious separation. So I can have faith in God and separate from Him and run my whole life. Anybody ever do that? You can go to church and pray for hours and get in your car and run the day and ruin it, make bad decisions. So it's a constant seeking of God's will in all your activities. Now, we'll finish up with this handout real quick. We're on page 143. And it says, the two black things, we need to remember to pray as if it all depended on God and work as if it all depended on us. So we want to depend on God, but we have to do His work. And then, he says, once we simplify our prayers and ask only for God's direction to carry them out, once we see God's directions throughout the day and act of them, we will see God working in our lives more and more each day. So then your faith with the works is alive. You see how that works? A passerby saw St. Francis tending a garden. He said, you must have prayed very hard, Francis, for things to grow so well. Francis said, yes, and every time I prayed, I picked up my hoe. Somebody told me once that when you pray for potatoes, the next thing you do is get a spade and start digging. You don't sit on the porch and wait for something to start happening. See, people come to AA and they do steps 1, 2, 3 and they think things are going to change. And they go to 7 meetings a week and, you know, they are very active in the fellowship, but they have to pick up the spade and start digging because they have to build a relationship with God. We have to get involved because we are promised that God will give us directions to power to carry them out. It's not magic. We still have to put the work into it. We have to get out there and get these things done. And so 10 and 11, the daily inventory and the nightly review and the praying and the meditation and the pausing, it's all related. He says in the 12 and 12 that prayer, meditation, inventory, when taken alone, are powerful. But when they're combined, it's a what's the term he uses? Unshakable foundation for life. There you go. Matt's been going reading the book. It's true, right, Matt? Yes.
Some days are better than others.
It doesn't say whether the days are good, but when you do it together, it's unshakable. All right, we were getting philosophy there. So when now people ask me about something, how's that going to work out? I think. If I knew how it was going to work out, I would be God, but it is anything compared to the things I've already seen work out. Remember, it says when we look back, the things that happened when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have imagined. It's like the story about the little woodpecker who was pecking on this great big old oak tree when lightning struck it and knocked it flat to the ground. All the other woodpeckers flew up to him and asked, how in the world did you do that? He said, well, I showed up where I was supposed to be and did what I was supposed to do, and God did the rest. I felt like that little woodpecker a lot of times. He says, I like the story of David, the little shepherd boy, and the giant Goliath. They asked David how he was planning to take on the giant. They point out to David that Goliath had armor, swords, spears, and all manner of weapons, that David only had some stones and a slingshot, and that Goliath was so big and David was so little. David told them a story. He said, when I was tending my sheep in the field, a lion came among my flock. David said, and this is what I consider the key, I went out and God delivered him to me. Then he said, I will go down into the valley and he will deliver Goliath unto me. The important thing here, I think, is that David is not trying to control outcomes. He knows that all he has to do is do his part. He doesn't have to wait until he figures out how God is going to do his part. That's what a lot of us have done. We just have to go ahead and go where we don't have to know how it's going to work out. We just need to know what God's will is for us. So he just had to go ahead and go where he's supposed to go and do what he's supposed to do and leave the outcome to God. The secret here is in David's faith, I will go out. So go out tomorrow. Go out with God all day long. See how it goes. this is all we're talking about when we ask for God's direction in our lives and the power to carry that out. We want the ability of the faith to say, I will go out and face life without knowing what the results will be. We don't have to worry about the results. We just, I didn't get up and say I wanted to see what the result is. I would say, God, keep me from practicing self-will. Keep me from separating. The only peace I have anymore is when I'm with God. That's all that matters. Money, anything, material things, they're not that important. They're not important. I just want to have peace. I just want to be at peace. You can have all the money in the world and all the possessions and have no peace. You ever watch TV, watch the news? Look at it. We need the courage to go out and do what we can. And as far as we can see that day and let go of the outcomes, we can have this for the asking. And then they have the picture of the arch to freedom, which those on the podcast, willingness is the foundation, believing is the cornerstone. The keystone of the arch is step 3, decision, and faith in step 12, and you've built your arch. And then if the faith keeps working, do you see the arch will stay up? If the faith stops, you don't do the work, the arch collapses. Okay, talk long enough. Thank you.